You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Today we have our guest that's backed by popular demand, Mr. Marin Katusa. Marin is an expert in the commodity sector and has participated in over $1 billion worth of deals. He's a regular contributor on the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, the New York Times, and CNBC. As an investor in hundreds of commodity businesses through the years, Marin has visited and toured over 500 different commodity businesses in the sector. And he's the New York Times bestselling author of the book, The Colder War, and he's the founder and CEO of Katusa Research. So without further delay, here's our interview with commodities expert Marin Katusa.
You are listening to The Investors Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Preston Pish. And as usual, I'm accompanied by my co-host, Stig Brodersen. And like we said in the introduction, we have Mr. Marin Katusa here with us. So, Marin, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
All right, Marin. So Stig's got the first question for you, so he's going to take it away.
Fantastic. So the main topic of today's discussion is gold, really where you are one of the top authorities. I was studying your research and I read that you found that the gold sector went from an almost 1-to-1 debt to equity ratio in 2007 to over 17-to-1 just a decade later. Keeping that in mind, which implication does that have for the retail investor strategy?
So this was a massive research project that I sent one of my analysts for 3 months going back to 1900. We went through every newspaper and public document we could find and every single producing gold company and all of their dividends. We combined this massive Excel sheet. And essentially what we came up with is a few things. You know, when you were growing up, you'd always hear the saying from, you know, the older people in your family about, wow, that's a gold mine. Gold mines used to pay people an incredible dividend and it was valuable to have something. What we found was going back from 1900 to about 1960, the average dividends for the gold producers was actually over 10%. Some of these were as high as 30% dividends a year. But things started changing in the late 70s and 80s. And, you know, when you look at, for example, the debt that you mentioned, or for example, the executive pay from 1900 to about 1970, the executive pay used to be somewhere between 3 to 5 times the mine manager. So the president or the CEO or the chairman of the company would get somewhere between 3 to 5 times what the actual mine site manager of the gold mine would make. In the early 80s, this started to change. And, you know, especially in the last decade where the executives, the CEOs, the presidents, the chairman, they would get anywhere between 30 to 100 times the pay of a mine manager. And the reality is in 2007 to this decade, when you talked about the debt going from 1-to-1, so the on the balance sheet of all the gold producers, it had about $17 billion in equity and about $17 billion in debt. Fast forward a decade because of the GFC, the global financial crisis, the gold producers dipped into that cheap money just as every other company did. And they went from 1-to-1 in 2007 to just under 18-to-1 actually. So what happened there? Well, the executives got paid on average 50 times the mine manager. The debt, recall, replaced the equity for dividend payments. So where the investors used to get dividends, now the debt guys get paid. And the problem with debt is you eventually have to pay back debt. And they take first security, meaning that the debt holders who've lent this executives who A, pay themselves enormous amounts of money, and B, the debt guys are guaranteed their interest rate, which has replaced yield. And then the investors who are in second place, the equity holders, the shareholders, they get left with the shaft. I call it the mine shaft, right? So they're not left with much. So if you look at, for example, fracking, enormous technological revolution that has really unlocked America, yet during that same time from 2007 to 2018, that decade there, the oil production growth globally was just over 20%, yet gold production increased 33% during that same time. That's when people talk about what the debt has happened. And unfortunately, it's not changing. You're seeing a consolidation of companies and it's become this thing where you're too big to fail. And the bigger you are, the lower your cost of lending is. So that's kind of where the sector's going.
So Marin, you have a newsletter that you send out to your subscribers about some of the picks that you're currently interested in. And I'm curious if you could talk about some of the gold miners that you are finding more valuable these days.
Sure. You know, I'm not the guy to go to if you're looking for a quick return. I'm not a day trader. I'm not a momentum guy. I'm what you call a contrarian value investor. So I get into things that are not popular. It's probably on page 15 of the newspaper or not even in the newspaper. And as it gets to the front of the newspaper, I start selling. Because something's not popular or people may not understand it today, I go to these site visits, I go underground, I go to the pits, I spend a lot of time. Most importantly, I become one of the largest investors in these deals. And now that it's popular and everyone's talking about it, I've already sold all my paper. So that's kind of my style to what I'm doing. I think the one that I think people need to pay attention to over the next few years, and again, this is not going to be by summer or, you know, American Independence Day, a 10 bagger, but I think over the next 2 to 5 years, it's going to be one of the biggest successes. And I'm also one of the largest shareholders, and you can buy stock today. You have to start with the people. There's a guy named Ross Beaty, who's a legend in the business. Very few people have returned their investors bigger gains than Ross has. Because of that relationship with Ross, I started becoming the largest shareholder in a company called Trek, where I brought these assets together. And I kind of talked to Ross, and he put some money in initially. And then I kind of had a big vision for Ross. And since then, that company became Equinox. And Ross has invested over $100 million of his own money. They have two producing mines. By next year, this time, they'll have a third producing mine. If you think of it this way, the NAV of the company is trading at 0.4. To put it in perspective, when I did Fosterville, it was trading at 0.4 NAV, but today it's trading at over 2x NAV. So I think Kirkland Lake's a little bit overvalued. You're paying for its success. Whereas Equinox, it's about a $500-600 million market cap company. You know, the insiders, I'm like, what, fourth largest shareholder. Ross is the largest. Richard Rourke's the second largest. It's about going and buying big assets, multi-generational assets. So one of theirs is like Arizona. That's going to have a 30-year mine life. Oil will produce 200 to 300,000 ounces eventually. Right now, it's going to produce about 150 a year. The company will be at this time next year over 300,000 ounces of production a year. And it's about low cost. You look at, I don't need $2,000 gold to make money there. I don't need $1,300 gold to make money. This company will make money at $950 gold. That's the thesis. Partner up with the best people in the industry, and you go and buy assets in a market where other people are selling because they have to pay their debt or for whatever reason. So, you know, fortune favors the bold, and I think everyone should take a look at that one. If you have a five-year outlook, I think you'll have a very, very happy ending to that one.
Now, I would like to go back to your research here, because you and your team have studied 35 years of data and 340 individual gold buyouts. This is gold buyouts for at least $50 million. And this goes back to the early 1990s. Could you, for the audience who might not be familiar with the concept, explain the concept of buyouts for gold stocks and the six important qualities that determines exactly what large gold miners are looking for in the acquisition process?
There really is three phases to the sector. There's the boom sector, where everybody's talking about future potential. Then there's the bust, reality kicks in. And then there's something called the echo, where you really have to develop and do what these management teams said they were going to do. So we're in the echo phase. And if you look at a lot of the M&A, so the mergers and acquisitions or the buyouts in the sector, it happens during the boom times. But then the smart guys, the guys like Ross Beaty and Lucas Lundin, the guys who've become billionaires and made their investors, you know, worth hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, they buy at the end of the bust, right at the beginning of the echo. You know, when you look at an exploration success story, a bunch of geologists go, they find something. Well, they're geologists, they're not engineers. So the whole concept is you take a high risk exploration project. If you find something, a big producer will come and buy you out because they are the developer. Well, a lot of that happened in the boom time. So from 2004 to about 2011, and then write downs happened. So the management teams realized that, you know, the metallurgy didn't work, or, you know, there was PAG, potentially acid generating rock, or the permitting became much more difficult, or the CapEx became, they thought it would be $700 million and it came in at three or four. You know, there was a project I know of I visited about 12 years ago. The CapEx was thought to be $900 million. It got bought out by one of the largest copper producers. It turned out to be an $8 billion CapEx. So you have to make sure that you look at the reality. What do the big producers look for in a buyout? Well, you know, it all depends. There's such a wide perspective. You know, is it open pit? Is it underground? What type of metallurgy, jurisdictional risk, permitting risk? That's a big one. So you'll see a lot of these companies that are in development. So they've already discovered the deposit and they've moved it towards permitting. Once you de-risk the asset, you're most likely to get bought out because now in the current market, a mid-tier or a big cap, a big company, doesn't want to take that permitting risk and that timeline risk on their balance sheet. So that's another factor that they look at. And the politics change. So Argentina for a while was a hot, hot place. It's become a very difficult place moving forward. You look at the success Chile and Peru have had. Alaska has its boom and bust. BC was a great place in Canada, Western Canada, British Columbia was a great place. Then it became a very difficult place. Then it became a great place. And now it's starting to become a harder place. So there's this cyclical shift. So you have to look at all the different factors in the M&A. So it's a pretty complicated game that you just can't think, well, this is a great project. It's going to get bought up. What are the factors and across the metrics, why will it get bought out? That's the biggest question you have to ask. And we basically broke down all those six factors for people.
So, Marin, I would like to take just a moment to dig a little bit deeper into the analysis and the metrics that you're using to conduct some of your valuations. If we were looking at a business outside of commodities, we'd look at things like the inventory turnover rate or how much the average consumer spends. But with commodities, it's just a little bit different. So I'm curious if you could talk to us a little bit about the specifics of the commodity industry.
This is a very deep dive question. So what you never want to do is when you look at the share price of the executive team, and if they're at a dollar and the stock's at $5, now you're not on the same wavelength. The skin in the game is different. So that's the first thing. So I will very, very rarely ever buy a stock when I'm paying a huge promo to the management team because it's all about risk to reward ratios. Then you look at the project, and in mining, they say grade is king, but you know, you have to look at what type of grade is it? Is the metallurgy work? Is there a lot of preg robbing or is it refractory? I'd rather own a 1 gram per ton oxide that's clean met than a twice or even three times the grade, which is refractory, because then you have to have $500 or $600 million capex for a roaster. So a lot of people get caught up on what type of grade, but grade is king. Metallurgy is absolutely important. And then the size of the deposit. The reality here is that a major, like the big caps, like a Newcrest, Goldcorp, Newmont, Barrick, they're not going to buy a 1 or 2 million ounce deposit if it's drilled out. They want essentially a 5 million ounce deposit that can produce 400,000 or 500,000 ounces or more a year and have an IRR after your capex of at least 15%. So they want, you know, a big mine life. That's called a tier one deposit. A tier two deposit is somewhere around 3 million ounces of gold that can produce somewhere north of 200,000 ounces a year and have an IRR of at least 20% or greater. So you have to look at where does your deposit come in. The problem with the industry is, you know, everyone uses these cash costs. Well, cash costs don't include your debt and G&A and all the different costs. It's just on-site costs. I use an all-in sustaining cost. So all-in, as a shareholder, what is my cost of that gold production? So that's another factor. And then you have to look at your jurisdictional risk. What's the cost? Are there streams or royalties on it? All these factors come in. So if you just go through all of these questions, you'll realize that, you know, of the 2,000 listed companies, it's Pareto's law. You really need to only focus on 40 or 50 companies. And then from there, you narrow down to which one you think is the best. And you don't need 25 gold stocks in your portfolio. That is a huge mistake people make. With myself, I have maybe 4 or 5. Don't overexpose yourself too early. Buy in tranches and follow what I call the matrix of questions to ask.
Interesting. As a nice segue to that, let's talk about the different types of gold stocks. You have stocks that are more sensitive to the price of gold than others. Why is that? And which type of companies is that?
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host 2 live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And I actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
If you look at the leveraged place. So for example, let's take someone like in Canada, very big open pit deposits called the Detour Mine. Detour Gold owns it. You have a lot of big fund managers battling over it. But the reality is it's a high cost producer. You know, at $1,300 gold, you're essentially, and I'm not trying to take a slag at the guys. Look, I'm not short it. I'm not long it. I don't own it at all. I'm using them as an example here. You're essentially moving rock and creating jobs. There's no profits for the shareholders at $1,300. But if gold gets to $1,450, $1,500, that's actually a massive cash cow because the margins go from nothing to, you know, much higher. So that these one mine producers that are high cost, as gold goes up, they get the best leverage. So those stocks can go, you know, I remember there's a couple of in the US, they went from $1 to $40. Back to $1. And remember, leverage works both ways, just like gravity. If the gold price goes down, these stocks get punished hard. The other way is if you look at these gold banks, so assets that gold deposits that have been drilled out by other companies in the past. For example, the top one right now in the TSX is a company called Gold Mining Inc. Ticker symbols GOLD, probably the best ticker for a gold company that you can have. And they just went and bought out these assets. And it's kind of a smart strategy because just in 2011, the companies that owned the different assets that they have had a $1 billion market cap. And now this company today has 100 million in change with over 10 in cash. And as gold gets to 1600, those ounces in the ground, which have been drilled out already, and they're moving them towards permitting and towards a development, they're just going to spin those out just like Ross Beaty did with Lumina Copper. And, you know, eventually it'll get back to that higher price. So that's kind of the two types of plays that you have the top leverage. For a lot of the big producers that have, you know, 15 different mines, you know, the price of gold moving from 1200 to 1300 is positive, but they're not going to get the massive lift that someone like a Detour or Gold Mining would have. I don't really base my fundamental decisions on that. I use, you have to pay attention to the US dollar. Remember, US dollar is the king of currencies currently. And if you look historically, the relationship between gold and US dollar, you pay attention to that. But really what I pay attention to is mine supply. I look at all the major mines and I have a spreadsheet that I publish. And it's of all of the producing mines in the world today, above 50,000 ounces of gold, who owns it? You know, where's the mine going? Is it depleting? Is it increasing in production? And there's this myth that every asset is going to shut down shortly. Well, look at Fosterville or look at some of these great mines that actually start producing more. I base my analysis actually more on a supply. The demand kind of meets itself. I don't focus too much on the demand. I focus on the supply in the sector. Really, when you look at the cost of what type of supply comes on, I published a lot on the Australian producers who are much more disciplined than the North American producers. And they use about, on average, about $1,000 an ounce gold, US dollar per ounce, for their reserves. Now, remember, reserves are how many ounces do I have currently economic at that price of $1,000, where if you look at a lot of the North American guys are using $1,200, $1,300 as their economics for reserve. So there's a lot of conservatism in the Australian guys, and they won't put mines into production if it doesn't meet its economic threshold at $1,000. I use $950. I like a margin of safety. Like I said, I'm not a gold bug. I'm a profit bug. I focus on things that are going to make me money, whether gold's at $1,150 or $1,450. That's my analysis.
So, Marin, you talked about gold reserves, and whenever we read about gold reserves, a lot of the times it's about how many hundreds of thousands of ounces they might be mining, but how much can we actually trust those numbers? And more importantly, how are those numbers being measured?
A lot of the numbers you have to go through, and if you look at the difference between, so in North America, we have something called a 43-101 because of the BRIEX disaster, the biggest scam in mining ever. They brought in these thresholds, so you have to get an independent audit. But even those, like what type of ounces are there? There's so many projects that I know of that I've been to that say, well, we got 8 million ounces. Fair enough, you have these ounces, but it's refractory or there's preg robbing there. You're not going to produce 8 million ounces at $1,200 gold. You're going to need $2,000 gold. So the question is those ounces are there. What price do you need to bring them into production economically where the shareholders get rewarded? That's the key question. But there is no shortage of gold. The question is at what price does that gold become economic? That's the key question.
For oil, we know that at different price points, a barrel of oil might become profitable even though that the reserve is not as accessible. For instance, $125 plus, you know, Arctic oil might become interesting, and a $200 plus, you know, ultra deep shore oil might become interesting. How much gold can be mined at which price points?
Well, right now we're hovering between, say, let's call it the $1,250 and $1,350 range, and we can maintain over 100 million ounces of gold production currently. What people have to really break down, there's primary gold production. So it's actually like a company that produces gold, like Equinox, it produces gold. You know, there's a lot of gold that's produced as a byproduct, just like silver. Silver's main production is actually byproduct. But if we focus just on primary production, there's over 100 million ounces currently that's economic at the current prices. Now, if we drop to, say, $1,000, you would see that number go down. There's no doubt about it. But you have a big chunk of secondary production that its primary metal, like copper or whatever the primary production is, like a copper gold porphyry, you basically get the gold as a secondary production. It doesn't carry the value because about 70% of the value comes from the copper. When people ask that question, what price of gold, you have to look at, well, what about copper? Because a lot of gold comes as a byproduct with copper. So that said, if we go the reverse question, if you ask me, what about $1,600 an ounce? It takes these mines many years to get from a production decision to ordering the equipment, like for example, a SAG mill. You know, these are massive, massive equipment. For example, up at our copper mine, you have 280-ton trucks. It's bigger than, say, a 3,000-square-foot house. That's how big these trucks are. The tires are 12 feet tall. These are $40,000 tires, and each truck has six of them. So it takes about 2, 3, 4 years to put a mine into production. So if gold stays at 1,600 for a few years, we could easily get to 120, 125 million ounces a year of production. And as it goes higher, as long as the price stays there, the problem is the price is so volatile, it's hard to plan a mine production and build a mine based off of a floating gold price.
Looking at the business cycle and looking at the credit cycle, where do you think that we are right now, and how does that affect gold mining stocks specifically?
There's the three phases. There's the boom, the bust, and the echo. I believe right now we're in the middle of the echo phase. I stated this, and again, even at my own conference, people were frustrated because they want me to say, this is the bottom of gold and now's the time to buy. I don't think that way. I think that we're a few years away from a real bull market in commodities. I think we will test lower gold prices. I believe we will test lower copper prices. It's not like I'm bearish, but I take a longer time view. So everything that I play, I don't play, oh, in 4 months, I have to be out of this stock. I'm not a momentum trader. I'm not a generalist fund. A lot of these generalist funds will hop in and out. That's another factor of why the mid-tiers and the juniors are trading at such a discount to NAV, because the big funds, so much money is managed by these ETFs and these generalist funds. They don't have the ability to do a deep dive in true value of mining. So they just want to buy a very liquid stocks, which means it has to be a big cap that they can get in and out and make it meaningful for them. So I believe we're in the middle of the echo and we have a few years to go. I could see $1,100 gold be tested here. And people get shocked when I say that, but I also believe we'll test 240 copper.
So Marin, I'm curious, we've been talking a lot about gold, but are there other types of commodities that you like just as much?
I think there's great opportunities in gold, but you know, there's only so much of your portfolio you can expose to one sector. I always remind people that there's never, ever, ever more than 10% of your portfolio in any one stock. That's just too risky. And I've done it in the past where I've gone big because, you know, I became a director of the company or the largest shareholder. I don't recommend that. I recommend prudence. And I think a sector that is so beaten down and so cheap, if you're a true contrarian and you want to buy value, I would look at uranium. Uranium is a great place. But again, I tell people, be very, very careful in uranium. I came up with like a phrase that the sector hates, and I call it the AK-47. So many of these projects, they're recycled. You know, it was drilled out in the 70s by Esso or some of these oil companies. The energy companies were actually some of the biggest producers and developers of these assets. You know, in Canada, there was a massive deposit called the Kitsmichelin. Back in 2006, it had almost $1 billion market cap. And I went up on stage and said, this is a POS, you know, like this will never be in mine. Back in the 80s, at $40 uranium, it couldn't work. Well, if you inflation adjust $40 uranium to today, that's over $100 per pound uranium. And if it couldn't fly back then, there really isn't any crazy innovations that could make it economic. So it's just too low grade. It's just a tough area to produce. So I think you have to look at lower costs. And I use for the upside, I think $45 uranium. If your project doesn't work at 45, I'm not going to be a shareholder. There's just a lot of people expecting uranium to go to $100. I think that'll be a great time for me to sell all my uranium holdings, not buy my uranium holdings. So that's a sector that I think is super cheap.
It's interesting how you talk about different sectors and how much to be exposed to a sector. You also talk about position size. How do you think about entering and leaving a sector or a stock for that matter? And how much is just good old buy and hold?
You have to treat your portfolio like any other relationship. You have to spend time on it, just like going to the gym. And you cannot buy and hold and forget in the resource sector. It's too risky of a sector. For example, if the management team are meeting their milestones and doing well, well, you hold the stock. But let's just say the stock is cheap, but the management team are not hitting their milestones. Well, you either become a proactive, active investor, or you don't want that fight, you sell your stock, because even if it's cheap, the management are hitting the milestones. If you're not willing to fight for the asset, sell your stock. But when stocks get fair value or above, it's time to move your money somewhere else because you have to grow that money. But also keep a nice position of cash because luck is being prepared when the opportunity arises. And what really set me apart from all of the other funds in the sector was in 2012, by serendipity, I went cash and I just believed the sector was fairly valued. Everyone thought the bottom was 2014. Well, it dropped another 30, 40%. And that's when I made my big moves on Fosterville, Northern Dynasty, Altera in late 2015. So you have to have cash. Like I've never been fully invested in the sector. And when the stock starts running, you do have to sell some. You know, if a stock triples, sell half, get your principal, keep it ready for a new opportunity and let the rest run and ride. And if it doesn't work out, you can sell, you've still made money, but you have nothing at risk. That's the key. If there's one thing your viewers take from me, it's about risk mitigation, because resources is so different than investing in a technology sector or biomedical sector or a utility sector. There's so many things that can go wrong in the resource sector because you're moving significant rock and you're extracting the ore from that rock. Look what's going on with the tailing ponds. There's so many factors you have to invest in and understand in the sector. So if you can mitigate your risk by pulling out your capital, that is the absolute best strategy to succeed in the resource sector.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show. It's absolutely amazing bringing you here on the show, Amar. And I'm sure when everyone saw the title and they know we're going to talk about gold, they would be like, oh, Amar must be a gold bug. And you have all this just been bashing that, which has been really interesting addition here to the discussion.
It's about making money in a bad market. And if you can mitigate your risk, I guess I'm the pin that pops a lot of people's investment fantasies, and they don't like that. And your crappy recycle project in an AK-47 region that needs $90 uranium to even bring into production. A lot of people don't like to hear the realities, and it's crazy. This is investing. You're supposed to be not emotional. You don't fall in love with the stock. You have to almost be robotic, or you can't have sympathy for the management team. If they're not doing what they said they did, sell the stock and go to someone who does what they say they're going to do.
Very interesting how you keep on talking about the downside. And as you're saying, the upside will take care of itself if that is indeed true.
That's why I love private placements. First of all, the whole private placement model and allowing retail people, as long as you're accredited, the big brokers, the big fund managers, they get access to deals because they go on TV or they have a following or they're at the conference. And I said, wait a second, they have an edge. So of course they're going to sell their stock and they ride their warrant. So what I created was, hey, wait a second. If I'm going to get into a stock, let my people get in at the same price at the same time. We take no fees. There's no way a company can buy their way into my newsletter, the KRO, we call it, the Catoosa Resource Opportunities, unless I'm buying at the same time with my subscribers and we get a warrant. And then when I upped it even one more, I'm saying, look, let's list these warrants so they trade like a share also. And we've done it many, many times. That's how you can get an advantage of buying your first tranche in a financing. And if the stock, when you talk about its upside, takes care of itself, you can sell your share or your warrant, one or the other, and then you can ride the profit with the upside of the warrant. So you nailed it. Cover your bases, mitigate your risk. The upside will take care of itself. But if you can invest in private placements, that's how you get a double whammy for your dollar.
So this is really quite fascinating. Private placements is one of the things that you talk about on your Catoosa Research Opportunities Report. Could you tell our audience just a little bit more about this? And just in case you're wondering, we'll put some links in the show notes for folks if they want to dig into some of these reports a little bit more and learn a little bit more about private placements.
First of all, if I'm going to publish something, my subscribers get in at the same price at the same time as myself. And I'm usually one of the largest investors in the deal. So the report that you talked about is exactly that. I created a very conservative, almost like a short report. And how do we make money in the sector? And then here's the company opportunity. Another great opportunity I published for free on my website was when I did the whole Northern Dynasty story. The companies, they're not producing anything. They need money to move towards a permit or to drill their holes or for whatever, even G&A, they have no income because they're not producing anything. So they need to go investors and do a financing. So a PP, a private placement, is when they take outside investors to invest in it. So when I did Northern Dynasty and all my subscribers who wanted to get in at the same time, we published that. It was a 45-cent unit. A unit comes with a share and a warrant. So it was a 45-cent share, and you got a 65-cent warrant that's listed, so it's free trading, for 5 years. It's like an option on a stock that you can exercise for 65 cents. And by less than 12 months later, the share price was $4.50, and those warrants were trading at $4. So let's just say, hypothetically, you only bought the stock. You bought the stock at 45 cents. It went to $4.50. You made about 10 times your money. But if you had those warrants, you haven't really paid for those warrants. They're listed in free trading and they traded at $4. Now you've made 18 times your money. So that's why I love these warrants. If you get it right, you get paid twice and you get it really, really paid right. That's what a private placement's all about.
Very, very interesting concept. I definitely encourage everyone to check out that free sample. Maureen, thank you so much for coming here on the show. Where can the audience learn more about you and Catoosa Research?
Just go to the Catoosa Research website for you. We've decided to publish a very conservative report to see my style. You have to spend time on these reports. This isn't a two-page report. I think it's a 20 or 30-page report that we're putting up for your crowd. And it's showing what the style is. My style is like, you can't just own a gym membership and think you're going to be successful. You actually have to go to the gym and do the work. You have to spend time reading my material and go through it and see if it's right for you. It's not right for everyone. If you want a quick hit or you're a day trader, again, I'm not your style. If you want a deep, deep research and dive and understanding the technical terms, I try to make it entertaining. I try to make it fun. So if you go to the website, there's a lot. There's 5 years of publishing for free. I publish every week for free. Just go to Catoosa Research /tip and you can get the report there and plus my second book for free.
That's absolutely amazing. And again, I'll 100% encourage everyone to check that out. So catoosaresearch.com/TIP. And we're also going to link to your free samples and the other resources you mentioned here. Maureen, thank you so much for coming back on The Investors Podcast. We hope we can convince you to come on the show another time.
It's always a pleasure. Take care of yourself and have fun.
That was all that Preston and I had for this week's episode of The Investors Podcast. We see each other again next week.
Thanks for listening to TIP. To access the show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. To get your questions played on the show, go to asktheinvestors.com and win a free subscription to any of our courses on TIP Academy. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making investment decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the TIP Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.